low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 18th, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Thank you for joining us today. The highlights under Business and Finance are L3 Harris Technologies, the contractor that overhauled a Qatari jet for use as Air Force One, replaced Christopher Kubasik as chairman and CEO after an investigation found he violated the company's code of conduct. Major U.S. stock indexes fell, and oil prices and bond yield advanced on evidence of persistent tension in the Middle East. The S&P 500 and Dow each shed 0.5%, and the NASDAQ gave up 0.3%. Paramount asked a judge to require 12 states and the Writers Guild of America to put up a nearly $1.9 billion bond for challenging its acquisition of Warner Brothers Discovery, money that would go to the company if it wins the case. OpenAI signed a 10-gigawatt data center deal in Ohio with SoftBank's SB Energy that is partly backed by NVIDIA, a project expected to become one of the largest AI hubs to date. Manufacturing last month rose to its highest level since 2022, driven by AI infrastructure development and companies pivoting to serve its needs. Confidence among U.S. home builders barely picked up in August amid high mortgage rates, rising construction costs, and economic uncertainty. One of China's pioneering car executives, Li Shoufu, is stepping down from the leadership of his group's core auto unit after building it into an export powerhouse. A new survey from KPMG offers a glimpse of changes in financial reporting that could emerge from an SEC proposal to loosen filing frequency. Now for the highlights under the worldwide section. Trump threatened to bomb Oman, a country that has exercised its good offices in search of a deal between Washington and Tehran, alleging that it might be standing in the way of an agreement to end hostilities. Attorney General Todd Blanche launched a process to allow individuals who lost their gun rights because of felony convictions to apply to have them reinstated. The Supreme Court again rebuffed Trump's push to toss a jury's $5 million finding that he sexually abused the writer E. Jean Carroll and later defamed her. The erasure of temporary protected status for Haitian immigrants since July 27th has hurt South Florida businesses, where many Haitians worked. U.S. kindergarten vaccination rates inched down again last year, and the share of children with exemptions rose to an all-time high, federal data show. Luigi Mangione's state murder trial was delayed as his defense team made a bid to dismiss charges there after he admitted in federal court to killing UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. Construction work in Big Bend National Park has been temporarily halted, Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Rodney Scott said, while he assesses the Texas site. Thunderstorms, heavy rain, and flash flooding continue to threaten a swath of the U.S. from the Midwest to the Mid-Atlantic. A Russian court convicted a prominent opposition politician for speaking out against the war in Ukraine and sentenced him to 11 years and 1 month in prison. The picture on today's front page shows in the background demolished large apartment buildings and in the foreground makeshift tents. And that caption reads, "Tents shelter Palestinians amid destroyed buildings in Gaza City. President Trump said Israel should halt attacks as his envoy Jared Kushner met Monday with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to try to salvage a U.S. plan to disarm Hamas." The headline, "President pushes Israel to stop strikes on Gaza." The article by Felice Solomon and Summer Saeed, Tel Aviv. "President Trump said Israel shouldn't be striking targets in Gaza as envoy Jared Kushner met Monday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to salvage the president's plan to disarm Hamas and end the war in the Palestinian enclave. In a rare public break between the close allies, Netanyahu last week rejected Trump's plan for a phased disarmament by Hamas. After a brief pause, Israel resumed near daily strikes against Palestinian militants, including some that Israel says took part in the deadly October 7, 2023 attack and hostage taking. Trump told Fox News on Monday that Israel shouldn't be carrying out those attacks because he said Hamas has agreed to lay down its weapons. Ultimately, they are giving up their guns, Trump said, according to Fox chief foreign correspondent Trey Yingst. In late July, Trump said Hamas, a U.S.-designated terrorist group, had agreed to a 15-point road plan that would lead to Hamas surrendering its weapons to Palestinian authorities in exchange for the gradual withdrawal of Israeli troops from the Gaza Strip. The two foes, however, disagree about which side must go first. Israel has refused to pull back until Hamas has been disarmed. The meeting among Kushner, Netanyahu, and the Board of Peace officials ran more than 3 hours. They agreed the Israeli military won't redeploy from Gaza until Hamas surrenders its weapons, and that Israel would have the right to respond to threats, said people familiar with the matter. Israel retains its full right of self-defense. If Hamas resorts to terror, violence, or attempts to rearm, Israel will retain the right to act accordingly, a Board of Peace official said. Other articles from the front page follow. 6 crucial days on Wall Street brought hedge fund to brink. Bid to sell stake in Anthropic raised red flags on situational awareness for banks. David Mann was in a taxi heading to New York's LaGuardia Airport when he heard the news. Wall Street's AI wunderkind was in trouble. It was the afternoon of Wednesday, July 29th, and Mann got a call from someone working on behalf of Leopold Aschenbrenner's hedge fund, Situational Awareness, asking if he wanted to buy a piece of the fund's stake in Anthropic, the AI powerhouse. A deal needed to be done overnight, Mann was told. Mann realized what was happening. Nobody sells pre-IPO shares in a company valued at nearly $1 trillion unless they are on the ropes. Aschenbrenner was being forced to sell, said Mann, chief executive at the Manchin Group, a family office that owns stakes in Anthropic and other private companies. He needed the money and was sounding people out. For 2 years, Aschenbrenner, a 20-something former OpenAI employee, was on a roll. By Gregory Zuckerman, Juliet Chung, and Peter Rudiger. At his peak, his fund controlled some $100 billion in assets, including the enormous sums he was borrowing from banks to supersize his artificial intelligence stock bets, from semiconductors to software. Buzz that he was an AI Nostradamus helped the effort. By late July, the chatter had changed. Aschenbrenner was facing steep losses from tumbling AI stocks, and he was desperate for a way out of his investments, people familiar with the situation said. Banks were issuing margin calls or demands for more collateral to back their lending. Elite investors, including Steve Cohen and Daniel Loeb, heard of the Anthropic sale. Short sellers were targeting Aschenbrenner's favorite stocks. It felt like he was being hunted, said John Pfeiffer, co-founder of Pfeiffer Capital, a family office that has invested in Situational since its inception. The swift unwind of Situational shows how quickly information can spread across Wall Street when a trader is in trouble, and how fast it can lead to an avalanche of selling. It is a brutal lesson, too, in the risks of leverage or investment bets fueled by borrowing several years after Archegos' capital's implosion. Aschenbrenner built his firm on his reputation as an AI soothsayer. Others pointed to lengthy investing track records when launching hedge funds or venture capital funds. Aschenbrenner's stature stemmed from a 165-page essay in 2024, Situational Awareness, The Decade Ahead, that foresaw the path of AI's development. From the beginning, his firm promised to make concentrated bets on stocks that would benefit from AI's broad adoption, from chip makers to infrastructure providers, while betting against stocks that would be disrupted by AI, including software makers. Aschenbrenner got a helping hand from Wall Street. Lending to hedge funds is giving bank earnings a boost, and a number of banks were eager to back a new manager trading the market's hottest theme. As it grew from about a $1.5 billion in assets under management last summer to over $45 billion at the start of July, Situational borrowed about $3 for each $1 of capital it held, and sometimes even more. People familiar with the matter said, above the leverage used by funds trading such volatile kinds of shares. Situational also purchased flex options, a customized derivative to amplify its AI trade. This very long article tells how the crash occurred. Situational gave its investors the bad news. The fund shed about 67% so far that month, about $30 billion, though it remained up 80% for the year. Its investors are tallying their own losses. Jane Street, the powerhouse Wall Street trading firm that is one of Situational's major investors, dropped about $15 billion in July, much of it because of Situational's troubles. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Frustrated over war, Trump threatens ally Oman. President discusses bombing Gulf State, which is in talks with Iran to reopen the strait. By Alexander Ward and Robbie Gramer, Washington. President Trump's frustration with his inability to end the nearly six-month war with Iran boiled over Monday into again threatening to bomb Oman. The latest U.S. partner to draw the president's ire over his view that the country is doing little to resolve the conflict. Quote, I don't think they behaved very well, but we'd handle them very easily just like we do others, Trump said Monday in the Oval Office. He didn't go into specifics about what Omani officials did that drew his ire. Earlier, he had told Fox News in a phone interview, if Oman gets in the way, we'll bomb the S out of them. U.S. officials said the dynamic with Oman was murky. The Persian Gulf country that borders the Strait of Hormuz to the south is in talks with Iran to allow more commercial traffic in the waterway. U.S. officials said those negotiations were progressing and could relieve pressure on the global energy market and higher domestic gas prices. But there is lingering concern within the administration that Oman could aid Iran in brokering a nuclear deal more favorable to Tehran, feeding Trump's anger. Oman is the latest country to draw Trump's anger for not, in his view, doing more to help end the Iran conflict that he started alongside Israel. On Sunday, he ordered a cut to a joint U.S.-South Korea military drill because Seoul wouldn't help pry open the Strait of Hormuz. Wait a minute. We have 39,000 soldiers over there guarding you from Kim Jong-un, your next-door neighbor, and you're not going to help us on a very easy military operation in Iran? That's strange. Trump, a Republican, has also complained that European allies like the UK or Spain haven't done enough to counter Iran, an extension of his decades-long gripe that allies take more from the U.S. than they give. A debate has raged within the administration about how to handle Oman. Some senior aides privately accuse Oman of being a duplicitous actor that largely sides with Iran instead of seeking the best possible deal between Washington and Tehran, officials said. Others said Oman's long-standing ties to Iran are a boon to the mediation process. Those officials assert that Trump is scapegoating Oman as he seeks others to blame for struggling to complete a nuclear deal. There is also concern that the Iran-Oman deal could solidify Tehran's control over the strait, U.S. officials said, noting Trump prefers an agreement that fully reopens the passageway through which a fifth of the world's oil and energy flowed before the war. Trump has told aides he would consider declaring Iran's path to a nuclear weapon blocked and the war won if Tehran agreed to fully open the waterway, the Wall Street Journal has previously reported. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has repeatedly said that Iran's tolling the Strait of Hormuz would be a red line for the Trump administration and set a dangerous precedent for other strategic international waterways around the world. Iran's secret plan to escalate war. Intelligence suggests a strategic shift to raise the cost for U.S. and allies. By Benoit, Falcon, and Summer Saeed. After President Trump signed a memorandum of understanding with Iran in mid-June, administration officials fanned out to build support for an agreement they hoped would reopen the Strait of Hormuz and start winding down the war. Iran's hardline leaders huddled in Tehran and came up with a different plan, according to Iranian and Arab officials. In their view, the pact was likely just an attempt by the U.S. and Israel to take pressure off the global economy and buy time for a bigger attack down the road. Instead of putting faith in talks, they took the past 2 months to prepare for a bigger fight. Their efforts include giving the powerful Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps more control of the country's regular army, appointing hardened veterans of war with Iraq and past internal crackdowns to key posts, expanding domestic counterintelligence operations, and ramping up production of missiles and drones. The leadership quickly seized the initiative, attacking ships to tighten Iran's grip on Hormuz and expanding the battlefield to the Red Sea, which Saudi Arabia has used to get around Iran's chokehold on the Persian Gulf. Arab intelligence officials have picked up evidence, including communications between Iran and militia allies in countries such as Yemen and Iraq, of a strategic shift inside the country's hard-line leadership to get their forces ready to widen the war and raise the cost for the U.S., officials familiar with the findings say. Alarming weaker Gulf countries like Kuwait, Iran's leaders are increasingly talking about offensive operations on enemy territory. Their overriding goal is to inflict enough pain to ensure the kind of attacks Iran has endured with the 12-day war last year and the continuing conflict aren't repeated. There is also a widespread view in Iran that the main war has not yet begun. The Iranian preparations point to an enormous gulf between how Washington and Tehran are perceiving this stage of the war. The divergence has driven a hardline negotiating stance and reluctance to close deals by Iran's leaders that has persistently flummoxed Trump, who has called them crazy and accused them of lying. Iran's readiness to fight also highlights a deep lack of trust that is likely to keep the two sides from reaching a durable deal to end the conflict anytime soon. Haitians' loss of job status hits employers in Florida. by Arian Campo Flores and Sanae Hadidja Rashid. The abrupt loss of Haitian workers is rippling through South Florida businesses. Some home care agencies have shut down since July 27th, when the Trump administration ended temporary protected status, or TPS, for Haitian immigrants. The administration argued the program had become permanent in contrast with its intended purpose. Nursing homes are scrambling to fill vacant positions, and restaurants are scaling back operating hours. Hotels, retailers, airport contractors, and small businesses are also grappling with new staffing shortages. As a result of the change, which terminated employment authorization for TPS beneficiaries, Jewish Community Services of South Florida had to let go of 18 Haitian TPS holders, some of whom had worked as home health care aides at the organization for more than 20 years, said Chief Executive Miriam Singer. The organization provides home care for about 400 Holocaust survivors, she said. The organization is racing to fill those positions, a steep challenge in an industry that struggles with persistent labor shortages. Meanwhile, it is leaning on remaining staff to work more hours and paying significant overtime as a result. Leaving the front page, Paramount seeks stiff penalty from deal opponents, by Joe Flynn. Paramount on Monday asked a judge to require 12 states and the Writers Guild of America to put up a nearly $1.9 billion bond for challenging its acquisition of Warner Brothers Discovery, money that would go to the company if it ultimately wins the case. The aggressive maneuver came in a motion arguing that the plaintiffs should be held financially responsible for damages Paramount suffers during litigation seeking to block the $81 billion deal. Paramount specifically wants the bond to cover the roughly $9 million a day, or $650 million a quarter, ticking fee it will owe Warner's shareholders if the deal hasn't closed by October 1st. The ticking fee was an incentive to persuade Warner shareholders to support its bid for the company over rival suitor Netflix. Under Paramount's request, it would receive the bond funds if it prevails in court. Trump's trade war drives apart GM, Ford, by Sharon Turlip and Gavin Bade. The century-old clash between Detroit's auto giants has a new battleground, the U.S. trade war with the rest of the world. General Motors and Ford Motor have tried to present a united front as they grapple with a chaotic Trump administration trade policy that is costing automakers billions and scrambling the global supply chain. Behind the scenes, the crosstown rivals are clashing as each company jockeys for tailored tariffs and policies while claiming to be the most American automaker. They are pleading their cases to policymakers, with each trying to stake a claim as being most fundamental to the U.S. economy as talks intensify around overhauling a North American trade deal crucial to each business model. Ford, for instance, wants higher tariffs on imports from South Korea, where GM builds its most expensive cars. GM is targeting aspects of Ford's electric vehicle battery strategy. The friction reflects how fundamentally different the two Detroit giants have become, as diverging manufacturing footprints and supply chains have led them to seek contrasting favors in Washington. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, Trump romances Kim Jong-un again. President Trump is nothing if not impulsive, and his latest brainstorm is to rekindle his courtship of North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. He announced Sunday evening on, where else, social media, that he had ordered the Pentagon to substantially reduce U.S. military exercises with South Korea that were set to begin on Monday. Mr. Trump cited his very good relationship with Mr. Kim, adding that military exercises send a signal that is totally inappropriate and hostile to a country that, as long as Donald J. Trump has been president, has been unthreatening and respectful. To the contrary, pulling back from the exercises sends a message of weakening deterrence and readiness against a regime that has a history of threats and aggression against the South. The North had protested, as usual, ahead of the routine exercises, and Mr. Trump's order is an act of appeasement toward Mr. Kim. The U.S. president also took a shot at South Korea for not helping the U.S. with the denuclearization of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The implication is that Mr. Trump is willing to reduce U.S. deterrence in the Korean Peninsula out of pique because Seoul isn't helping in the Strait of Hormuz. This is the same South Korea that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth praised in May for its pragmatism and leadership in raising its defense spending to 3.5% of GDP. This will reinforce the growing belief in Asia and Europe that the U.S. is becoming an unreliable ally. It may also increase the calls in the South for Seoul to develop its own nuclear deterrent to counter the growing nuclear arsenal in North Korea. Mr. Trump may not mean for any of this to happen, but in the wake of Mr. Trump's uncertain trumpet on Iran, the world is wondering about U.S. staying power. On that note, Mr. Trump might be trying to change the subject from the stalemate with Iran over the Strait of Hormuz, or he might be trying to appease Mr. Kim at a moment when U.S. weapons stocks and deployments are stretched. The U.S. is currently moving its last aircraft carrier task force out of the Western Pacific to relieve the USS Abraham Lincoln that is coming home after an extended deployment. China is happy to see the USS George Washington leave the Pacific as it seeks to persuade countries in the region that they can't count on the U.S. for defense. China may not use this opportunity to move against Taiwan, but it has been ratcheting up its aggressive moves against Taiwan, Japan, and the Philippines in the East and South China Seas. In his first term, Mr. Trump also called off U.S.-South Korean military exercises in an attempt to persuade Mr. Kim to give up his nuclear weapons program, to no avail. The U.S. president still covets a peace accord with the North, and with only 2 years left in his second term, who knows what he might be willing to do to get it. Don't rule out a unilateral decision by Mr. Trump to reduce U.S. forces now stationed in South Korea. In anticipation, the House Defense Authorization Bill bars the president from spending money on reducing U.S. troops in Korea below the current 28,500. Frustrated by his decline in the polls and the lack of a clear victory against Iran, Mr. Trump is likely to become even more volatile in his foreign policy moves. Without the late Lindsey Graham to warn him away from bad decisions, will other Republicans in Congress and inside the administration speak up? A Senate food fight on welfare waste. Democrats want to delay state accountability for improper payments. The Senate finished its business before summer recess like a college senior pulling an all-nighter on term papers assigned long ago, from government funding to confirming nominees. But after the farm bill flopped in committee, it's worth warning the GOP not to compromise last year's victory to reform food stamps. The feds traditionally pay 100% of benefit cost for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, and the states have little incentive to be good stewards of free money. Roughly 20 states last year had improper payments north of 10%. The GOP's One Big Beautiful Bill will soon force states with error rates above 6% to cover some of the benefits tab. Those with good management will keep paying nothing. Yet Democrats are howling about the inhumanity, and even some red states don't want to put up extra money. I will not support a farm bill that does not at least provide more time for states and counties to prepare to shoulder the cost of SNAP, Senator Chuck Schumer recently said. The farm bill failed this month at the Senate Agriculture Committee in a 10-11 vote with a pair of Republican absences. Democrats demanded a 2-year delay of this state accountability for improper SNAP payments, but their real goal is to push it off indefinitely. The Senate GOP's farm bill draft offered a 1-year reprieve. All of the Agriculture Committee's Democrats voted it down. Senator Amy Klobuchar, the ranking member from Minnesota, argues the cost-sharing provision has perverse incentives, and she has a point. Republicans in their original bill gave states with especially high error rates, 13.3% or more, extra time to comply, a sop to win over Alaska senators and passed the bill. Alaska's error rate in 2025, 23.15%. This means states could benefit by doing a worse job managing SNAP if sneaking over 13.3% error threshold lets them delay accountability and avoid millions in cost. Yet the answer is to fix that bad provision, not punt the entire project. The Foundation for Government Accountability projects a 1-year postponement could cost $5.7 billion to $7.5 billion. More important, spendthrift states would read a delay as evidence that the policy will never be allowed to take effect. The House Farm Bill doesn't include a similar delay, and the risk is that Republicans accede to Democratic demands to push through a farm bill. Not worth it. The best path after the Senate's bills committee failure on both the merits and the politics is to hold firm on the original 2028 effective date. Democrats and their media allies have already called Republicans heartless for touching food stamps at all. But Democrats aren't relitigating GOP work requirements for food stamps, and perhaps that's because they're popular. So is asking states to have skin in the game in the country's vast welfare state. The SNAP program long ago kicked free from its intended purpose of providing temporary grocery help in hard times. Budget analyst Matthew Dickerson and Brian Riley note that the roughly $100 billion in annual outlays is $25 billion above what the Congressional Budget Office baseline predicted in 2021. If Democrats really want to defend a blank check forever for improper payments, let them. From the opinion pages, Trump's Iran War Gordian Knot by Ludovic Hood. What would Alexander the Great do? Deprive Tehran of oil revenue and rally allies against the regime. More than 2,300 years after Alexander the Great is said to have confronted the Gordian Knot while pursuing the Persian Empire, President Trump and his administration face their own conundrum in Iran. Mr. Trump is caught between political constraints that prevent using adequate military force to change Tehran's behavior and a defiant regime willing to risk severe economic pain to rebuff Washington's demands. The White House seems to have settled on a campaign of economic pressure, a pause of sorts, until after the November 3rd U.S. midterm elections or the new year. The risk is that such a containment policy could ossify into a stalemate that the regime will claim as a win. After defying America's dictates, Tehran would end up with de facto control of the Strait of Hormuz and its axis of resistance, while diminished, still potent in the Shiite crescent. Slicing through this Gordian knot and arriving at a satisfactory outcome, namely a subdued or new government in Tehran, depends on two lines of effort: waging economic warfare against the regime's revenue sources and rallying partners to undermine Iran and its proxy network in the region. Mr. Trump should give Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Secretary of State Marco Rubio a blank check to strangle the Iranian economy, above all, sources of Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps funding, and to launch a focused diplomatic effort. This effort would be backed by judicious use of force, leveraging regional allies' capabilities to kneecap pro-Iran militias in Iraq, the Houthis in Yemen, and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Iran's divided leadership is already on the back foot internally and regionally. The Trump administration can damage the regime in both theaters and hasten its demise. Domestically, 4 popular uprisings since 2018, including nationwide protests this year, illustrate the Iranian people's discontent with dire economic conditions brought on by the policies of a doctrinaire, venal, and inept regime. The already frail economy is reeling from an estimated $270 billion in damage to infrastructure from U.S. and Israeli airstrikes, equivalent to about 60% of Iran's annual output. Oil exports have fallen by more than 70% since the onset of the U.S. Navy's blockade of Iranian ports. In the past 2 months, actions by the Treasury Department have further squeezed Tehran's access to revenue from oil sales and from illicit financial networks. Mr. Trump should let Mr. Bessent turn up the economic pressure on China and other countries, providing support to Tehran. In addition to new sanctions against Iranian actors and third-party enablers of illicit transactions, the Treasury, State, and Justice Departments should vigorously enforce existing sanctions, including by going after shadow intermediaries and transshipment hubs, whether based in Shanghai, Singapore, or Dubai. Sustained economic pressure will exacerbate inflation, capital flight, and the banking crisis in Iran. The regime's grip on power will almost certainly slip as the economy buckles under this campaign. Iran's regional proxy apparatus has been badly mauled in the series of conflicts precipitated by Hamas's October 2023 attack on Israel, by the fall of the Assad regime in Syria in late 2024, and by American and Israeli airstrikes in the past 6 months. New governments in Beirut and Baghdad have shown a willingness, albeit tentative, to rein in Iran-backed militant groups. Much work remains to degrade Iran's ability to unleash proxies to attack America's Gulf allies, Israel or U.S. interests elsewhere, as well as its ability to dictate political developments in Beirut and Baghdad. President Trump should empower Mr. Rubio to enlist Arab allies in a campaign to weaken Iran and its regional proxies. Leaders in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Qatar, all economic and strategic partners of the U.S., know that Iran crossed a Rubicon with its missile and drone attacks on their capitals and infrastructure. They and other Arab governments, though threatened by Iran, appear incapable of projecting unity or conviction. U.S. diplomatic engagement can reassure and galvanize our regional allies. A campaign led by Mr. Rubio can bolster efforts to degrade Iran-backed militias in the region. American-led diplomacy can help resolve differences between Abu Dhabi and Riyadh over Yemen and the Houthis. It can facilitate Gulf allies' respective roles in strengthening new governments in Baghdad and Beirut as they put pressure on Iran-backed groups and improve overall governance. Political and other domestic constraints have hobbled American presidents' willingness to commit the military force necessary to achieve their objectives for the past 35 years. The Trump administration is no different. The president is unlikely to commit to a sustained bombing campaign, let alone boots on the ground. Fortunately, Mr. Trump, like Alexander the Great in 333 BC, has a way forward, one requiring patience and coalition building, reinforced by military threats and actions. Letters to the editor. Social Security needs more than the old menu. Joseph Sternberg is right that Congress is finally talking about Social Security's problems, but a panel of experts isn't going to fix anything by itself. We've heard the same list of solutions for decades. Cut benefits for the better off. Raise the retirement age. Raise taxes or cut benefits across the board. Some of those ideas may still have to be part of any final deal, but they don't get at the real structural problem. For more than 50 years, I have audited pension plans, designed retirement plans, managed and invested pension assets, and reported to plan beneficiaries. Private retirement plans operate under strict controls, independence standards, modern investment management theory, and a clear separation of trust assets from the assets of the plan sponsor. None of those protections apply to Social Security. The so-called trust fund has never been a real trust. Its money has been lent to the Treasury for years at below market rates. That practice needs to end. The fund should be separated from the general budget, placed under independent trustees, and invested the way private pension funds are invested, with a sensible mix of stocks and bonds. In addition, the federal government should make an annual contribution calculated by actuaries designed to put the system on a clear path to solvency by a specific future date. This is no different than what corporate retirement sponsors do to meet their obligations. Congress should look at these ideas before defaulting to the same old menu of tax increases and benefit cuts. From John A. Crone, Humble, Texas. Mayor Mandani's Corporation Blame Game. Regarding your editorial, Mandani's latest target, Amazon. Zoran Mandani's efforts to require Amazon and FedEx to use a specific type of delivery worker reflects a troubling belief that government should dictate how private companies operate. Having never run a business, Mr. Mandani, in telling major employers how to manage their operations, shows how staggering his conceit is. From Chris Richels, Scottsdale, Arizona. Same topic. Mr. Mandani and his fellow travelers on the city council attacked the private sector in general and large corporations in particular as enemies of the city of New York. As in the case of the pied-à-terre tax, the mayor can't stop himself from efforts to humiliate his targets, accusing Amazon leaders of exploitive subcontracting moves the Delivery Protection Act discussion from a public policy debate to a shaming exercise. Whether or not Amazon takes the mayor's hostility seriously remains to be seen. But if one of his large corporate employer targets leaves the city, it will hurt private sector employees, residents, and the city's financial health. From Peter A. Michel, Alexandria, Virginia. New topic: universities should prove their plain fare. Regarding your editorial, The New College Race Preferences, the Justice Department's finding that Duke law continues to discriminate, evidenced by higher scores among rejected applicants from some racial and ethnic groups than among accepted applicants from others, isn't unique to one elite law school. My organization, Do No Harm, submitted public records requests to all 94 public medical schools seeking post students for fair admissions data on race, GPA, MCAT scores, and admission decisions. Most schools either didn't respond, stonewalled the request, or demanded excessive fees to process the request. Among the 23 schools that responded by the time we published our findings, 13 showed that the average MCAT score of rejected Asian or white applicants exceeded the average MCAT score of accepted Black applicants. That is the same evidentiary pattern the Justice Department cited against Duke. Given the results from the minority of medical schools that fulfilled our data request, it is reasonable to suspect that racial discrimination in medical school admissions remains widespread. The administration should be applauded for holding Duke accountable to Title VI's Students for Fair Admissions prohibitions on race-conscious admissions. Fighting discrimination at scale will require that colleges publish admissions data and bring transparency to a process that still appears to treat applicants differently by race. From Ian Kingsbury, Do No Harm, Marblehead, Massachusetts. As an aside, I have friends that do not want to be judged by watered-down requirements. These minorities say it diminishes their hard work and achievement. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 18th issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Volunteer radio readers broadcast daily readings 24 hours a day of newspapers, magazines, books, and other printed matter to area people who are blind or have a print disability, who are provided reading radios. The Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service has broadcast almost 40 years of radio readings to those without sight. Our broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Radio Reading Studios are at 1199 Harlem Road in Cheektowaga. For more information on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, call 716-821-5555.